From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why Michiganders feel the Michigan dream is suffering.
We haven't made the headway to reverse this trend of disinvestment, you know, informed by a real sort of cut taxes and make us business friendly that's been going on for a decade or more.
We talk with U of M's outgoing president about the issues facing higher ed in our state.
It is not reasonable to expect that we can lower the cost dramatically and still keep the quality very high.
We look at the possibility of arsenic in our drinking water.
Women are more vulnerable to arsenic. So if 100,000 women drank the legal limit of arsenic every day, 730 of them would get lung and bladder cancer from it, according to the EPA.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. General Motors will pay at least $1 million to each family who lost a loved one in an accident caused by an ignition switch defect. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the details on GM's ignition switch compensation plan. But first, when you see one of those Pure Michigan ads, does it make you feel good inside, make you think, yes, that's what my state is about? Or does it leave you with an unsettled feeling, a feeling that you wish that was the Michigan we're living in, and somehow we have lost some of what we want for our state? If you harbor those unsettled, disappointed feelings, you're not alone. Not according to a new interactive report. It's called The Michigan Dream at Risk, out today from the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas. John Austin's director of the Michigan Economic Center, also the president of the State Board of Education. Not a very happy report, John. Tell us what you found.
Well, we, all of us, many of us, and I think the citizens, as we did focus groups and survey work and did some new documentary journalism over the last couple years, they really care so much about certain things that are special about Michigan and that also power our economy. And they're very concerned that the things that actually make the state go, great schools, great universities that are affordable, beautiful outdoors and clean water, and cities and communities that have, you know, good roads and good transportation and good services that aren't falling apart, all those things have been over the years kind of degraded and diminished. And so as we listen to citizens and as we put together a report a couple years ago that we're just not making the investments in our roads, in our communities, in our outdoors, in our higher ed, we wanted to go back and take a look at whether those trends were continuing, which they are. But we wanted to do it in a different way that really listened to the citizens and told their stories. And so we put together this new video, which is inspirational because we can make Pure Michigan real, but it also expressed the real concerns that people have about Michigan and not making headway on important things like better roads, better communities, better and affordable higher education.
What most surprised you, John, as you heard what people were telling you all across Michigan in this survey?
Well, you know, the report. You spoke to it in your intro. When we see those Pure Michigan ads, and there was one that struck a lot of us from a couple years ago, it was no voiceover, no Tim Allen this time. It was violins playing, and it was beautiful images, you know, great, beautiful outdoors and freshwater coasts, kids running out of the cottages to jump in the water. The number one public university in the country, which is this one here at U of M, kids looking in wonder at the DIA and at Hittsville and the cities and skyscrapers of downtown Detroit. Park cars on the open road, you know, driving this beautiful state. But you see that and you want to say, no, wait a minute. That beach may be fouled because we've had fecal matter and we haven't cleaned up our water. That number one public university, this great one here, is twice as expensive as it used to be. And a lot of people can't afford to send their kids to these great public universities. Watch out on that open road, you know, the potholes. We know that problem.
Yes.
So Pure Michigan is not real. It is this reality that we've all tasted, but it's not what it should be. So we've cut support over 10 years, a long time, not just in recent years. We're finally beginning to make a little headway, barely, with some higher ed support and some K-12 support and more preschool support. K-12, we're still not there. But the degradation, the diminished services, the real beat-up communities. I mean, people don't – they don't – they're upset about the roads, for example, not mainly because it costs them something when their tire needs fixing. They're upset because their communities aren't what they need to be. They're embarrassed. Who'd want to live and work and make their future in communities that are kind of falling apart? So we haven't made the headway to reverse this trend of disinvestment, you know, informed by a real sort of cut taxes and make us business friendly that's been going on for a decade or more. We've been doing that. We've cut taxes, but we've also absolutely diminished the support for the things that people really associate with Pure Michigan. Great universities, great education, communities where they can raise a family, be proud of those communities, and this glorious, beautiful outdoors that we're going to enjoy, you know, this week as we head up north for the 4th. We need to make Pure Michigan real, not just a kind of a marketing campaign mirage.
John, what do you think is behind those years of disinvestment? And by that I mean, didn't the entire country, and particularly Michigan, get slammed by the Great Recession, and we're still working our way out of that hole? And I'm wondering what else or who else is at fault here, do you think?
I hope for your listeners will go to themichigandream.org to see this interactive report in the video. We lay out the facts of this case, which are very compelling. We've, for 10, 15 years, cut higher ed support 30%, cut community municipal services for fire and water and police 30%. We've cut K-12. We've cut support for outdoor cleanup. And the main reason we've cut is not the fact that we went through this recession, which certainly hurt our incomes. Mm-hmm. It's because we've basically dismantled and don't believe that government – we bought into this idea that government can play no role.
We meaning?
Meaning the leaders of the state, the people that vote for them. We started cutting taxes under John Engler. The income tax cut, we've accelerated that in recent years with the business tax cut. The governor did certain good things. I'm for raising a tax on pensioners who are wealthy, but that money should have gone into things that people really want to support, like better schools, affordable higher education, and the roads. And look at the latest debacle. We have not been willing. Everybody agrees we have to raise some significant new money to fund our roads. Look at the roads in Ohio, just across the border. They put massive amounts of additional dollars in their roads. This theology of tax cutting as the path to economic growth, it disables the things that actually move the economy, which are great schools, great communities people want to live in, beautiful outdoors, and affordable higher education.
As I went to themichigandream.org and looked at the Michigan Dream at Risk, this interactive report, it strikes me that you are really aiming this at voters, which makes me wonder, do you feel voters haven't been engaged enough with Michigan's future?
Well, people support the things they're emotionally connected to, and we want voters to take a look, sign up, share their contact information so we can share them through the michigandream.org with all the groups that are trying to put pressure on legislators to make Michigan what it needs to be, to vote for the kinds of revenues that support affordable higher education. There's a woman interviewed in the video, Karina Odom, a young woman who basically says, I don't think I want to take on all that debt that I'm going to have to because we've cut funding for higher education in Michigan so dramatically. So I'm not going to reach as far for my future. That's disabling to the Michigan dream that we all believe in as the path to opportunity. And if we went back just to the tax rates that we had under John Engler, we'd have $6 billion, $6 billion more dollars that we could put – we could fix all the roads. We could make higher education affordable again. We could clean up our lakes and rivers and streams, which have been increasingly polluted and not pure Michigan. So we need to be willing to raise the revenue, and we need to give spine to our legislators and only the public through their voice that says – we actually care about these things that drive Michigan and drive our economy and make Pure Michigan real, and we're going to expect you to do that.
Based on what you found as you talked with citizens for this report, how would you characterize the leadership shown from 2004 to 2014? Because that's the time span you're looking at by our elected representatives in Lansing.
I think the leadership has been risk averse. And I am an equal opportunity blamer, Governor Granholm, and I'm a Democrat. You know, she was not willing to end the march of cutting taxes and kind of disabling support, with one exception. There was a little tax hike in the income tax. And if anything, Governor Snyder, who I know is not an ideologue of the right, believes in dismantling all government. He has been willing to advocate for more investment in roads and higher education. But the team that he's the leader of, the legislature, has a lot of folks that don't believe anything government does is worth doing, and we've got to continue to cut taxes. And that's not a recipe. I mean, we together come together and made the state what it is, and we built the greatest education system on the planet, which we've been disabling. We built this beautiful park system and outdoors to enjoy with our families that is Pure Michigan, purposefully together. Now that's been diminished. And we built this incredible – we invented the car and invented the cement highway and paved the state and created these great roads in Michigan first. And now we're not willing to make that real to make that promise of enjoying the open road with our kids as we go up north and have an embarrassment compared to our neighbor states? That's not what we need to be about in Michigan, and I think there's equal blame to go around, but there's equal opportunity to do better. If people let their voice be heard, go to themichigandream.org, send a message to your leaders that you want Pure Michigan to be real, not a nice ideal, because it can be done. We've done it before, and we need to get our act together and connect those investments and the facts of the case, you know, this diminished investment and its real impact. Our incomes have dropped more in Michigan, our family incomes, than any other state over the last 10 or 12 years. So this tax cut approach is not working to create more economic opportunity. It's good the auto industry has bounced back a bit, mm-hmm. thank goodness. That's unfortunately the major driver of our little economic uptick. We want the state to be so attractive, not falling apart, that every entrepreneur, every individual, every family can keep their next generation here, and folks will come back and choose the state to live, work, and run a business.
This new interactive report, The Michigan Dream at Risk, is available for you online. All you have to do is go to themichigandream.org. John Austin is director of the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas. And thank you so much for talking with us about this report, John.
Thank you, Cynthia. My pleasure.
Recently, we spoke with the owner of an alcohol delivery service. Remember the one called Drink Drivers? This was the company setting up operations in Ann Arbor. The drivers would deliver beer, wine, and spirits to customers. The idea, keep partiers at the party and off the roads. A couple of updates. First, the company has now changed its name to Klink, K-L-I-N-K. And now comes word that an investigator with the Michigan Liquor Control Commission heard reports about the company and started checking into whether Klink met state regulations. And it appears it may not have, especially when it comes to delivering liquor. So for the time being, Klink has temporarily stopped its Ann Arbor operations. I guess we're calling it a summer vacation. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Mary Sue Coleman has spent the past 12 years at the helm of arguably one of the most influential universities in the nation, the University of Michigan. During her tenure, the university faced a number of challenges, including financial cuts from the state and a challenge to its use of affirmative action in admissions. Coleman's last day as president is July 13th, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. I'm glad to be here.
Tuition costs all across the country, as you know, are at some of the highest levels we've seen. And we're actually at a point when many are questioning whether higher education is attainable because of the cost. Are we at a crisis point when it comes to the cost of tuition?
Well, you know, our cost of tuition has gone up because of the disinvestment by the state. In fact, we show that relationship one-to-one. And what we've done here at the University of Michigan is to work extremely hard to raise funding for financial aid and to make it available. In fact, I'm very proud that every year that I've been president, most of which had budget cuts, we were able to increase financial aid by a larger percentage. So, in fact, for even many of our middle-income families, the cost of going, the net cost of going to U of M is actually less than it was 5 or 6 years ago. So it's our responsibility to keep the University of Michigan accessible, and we're working very hard to do that.
What about a deeper fix? Can this problem of the spiraling tuition costs across the country, do you see this as something that can be fixed, and if so, how?
Well, you know, this is a matter of state disinvestment, and the more the states disinvest, the more it is a private cost to families. And of course, we're talking about that all across the country. We and other institutions are working very hard to be cost conscious and more efficient. But what we do is inherently costly because we have this one-on-one interactions between faculty and students, and we think that's extraordinarily important. But sure, I mean, we will all work to try to contain cost, but I think it is not reasonable to expect that we can lower the cost dramatically and still keep the quality very high, which is what we work for at Michigan. We're one of the best universities in the world, and we want to remain one of the best universities in the world.
You did touch on this in your first answer, but I'd like to go a little deeper if I could, that, you know, understanding that you have led the university through some very challenging times, weathering these ongoing state cuts to funding that happened during a major economic recession. Talk to us some more, if you will, about when you look at the university's financial state, how you feel about how University of Michigan has managed these cuts?
Well, I'm very proud of what we've done at Michigan because we have looked at every single part of the university to try to rein in cost. And a lot of our backroom operations are now very different from what they were before. We have done changes in purchasing, shared services, our IT rationalization. Almost every place that you look, we have worked very hard to constrain cost while not affecting the experience that students have in the classroom or the experience that they have outside the classroom, because really that's what makes the University of Michigan so special and what prepares students for great careers.
So I can tell you will want to keep these adjustments from landing on the backs of the students.
We work very hard to make the University of Michigan accessible. And, you know, as I said earlier, our financial aid has gone up dramatically. And, in fact, I'm so pleased that many of our alumni have stepped up to the plate to help. In fact, in our new fundraising campaign, we have a goal of $1 billion to raise for financial aid. The last campaign, we raised $540 million for financial aid. So we have been working very, very hard to diversify the revenue streams for the university and make it possible for students to get a great education at a reasonable cost.
President Coleman, as a public institution, you aren't just impacted by the ebbs and flows in funding from what Lansing decides to allow, but there have been times when politics has entered the picture. You've had to manage disclosure around stem cell research, benefits for same-sex couples. How challenging is it to negotiate that space between higher education and the legislature?
Well, what we have tried to do always is to stay true to our mission and to stay true to our principles, and I think we've done that pretty well through a challenging decade. But my goal is always to have an open dialogue with the legislators and governor and the people of Michigan to explain why we do what we do and why we think it's important, and I think that has served us well.
Has this state legislature been detrimental to the University of Michigan?
Well, during the time of the Great Recession, you know, the legislators had to make difficult choices. And I understand that. I wish that they'd been able to give us more funding, but it is what it is. What I'm encouraged about is that it seems like that the tide is turning. The legislature is understanding how important it is to invest in higher education. And we've had the backing of the business leaders of Michigan, the CEOs, who understand the talent that they need to attract for their companies. And they become big advocates for higher education and reinvestment in higher education. And I'm very heartened by that.
During your tenure, President Coleman, universities' use of affirmative action in admissions worked its way right up to the U.S. Supreme Court and gained national, worldwide attention, truly. And you have been vocal in your support of affirmative action. What made you take that position and do it in such a firm way?
Well, for us, I mean, we always felt like that this was the right thing to do, that it was important for higher education, that having diverse perspectives in the classroom is really provides the best quality education. And in fact, our argument in the Supreme Court rested on the idea of diversity in the classroom and why that is so valuable and helpful. And we had amicus briefs from many corporations as well as the U.S. military about the value of a diverse classroom setting. So we felt like it was right, and we felt like it would provide the best educational opportunities, and we wanted to do that for our students here at Michigan.
Then let's look ahead. How do you hope the university will treat diversity issues going into the future?
Well, you know, we will comply with the law in Michigan. Obviously, we will. We're working hard at it. We haven't always been perfect, that's for sure. This is a struggle for us. But I will promise everyone that this will continue to be a top priority for the university, and we will work to attract a diverse population of students to Michigan.
If you've just joined us, I am speaking with outgoing University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman, who is retiring after 12 years at the helm of what is arguably one of the most influential universities in the country. But I switch gears a little bit into something that is really a challenge for universities across the country, and that is facing how to stop sexual assaults on campus and how to properly handle the instances when they do happen. As an institution, are universities in a position to actually prevent sexual assaults as well as go deep and investigate complaints of sexual assaults?
You know, we have a responsibility for our students, for all of our students, to create a safe environment that they can learn and grow in. We certainly agree with the Department of Education's recommendations, and in fact, we were consultants to them because we have had some procedures in place for several years that they have thought were appropriate. This is an issue that we need to work on. We need to have more education. We need to explain to students when they first come to the university how important, being responsible for your own behavior is. And we have done that since I came to the university, but we're going to expand our efforts because this is a very important issue, and it's one that has gained a lot of national attention, as you know, in the last year.
Sure. And as you expand your efforts, is outside help needed? Where would that come from?
Well, we believe that we have the capacity within the institution to do the kind of educational programs that need to be carried out. We are always looking to others to see what they're doing, but the University of Michigan has really been in the forefront of these efforts, and we will continue to try to be as effective as we possibly can.
President Coleman, as an education leader, you and your peers are all very united in the message that students must be ready to perform and excel within a global economy. And you've certainly traveled the world a lot as president of the University of Michigan. You've been to China. You've been to Brazil. From that perspective, how do you feel students here are prepared for this 21st century economy?
Well, it is a growing, I think, issue within the United States. And certainly when many students come to us, they haven't had any experience abroad. And that's why I'm so happy that in all of these trips that I've made, what I've tried to do is to provide expanded opportunities for our students, either to study abroad or to visit or to work on a project. Many of our classes now, students get together and work on international projects. We have many more international students coming to the university, particularly at the undergraduate level, and we are constantly finding ways to have both parties, that is, the domestic students and the international students, benefit from that association. So I think we are changing as a university as we become more global. We have portals now in Mandarin, in Portuguese, in Spanish, and in Hindi, where people from those countries can access our website and really know what we're doing as a university. So I'm very excited about the possibilities for our students and our faculty in the future. There are a lot of good openings that they can collaborate and work together.
As you prepare to leave, I'm wondering, what do you hope you will see from the University of Michigan looking ahead in the next 10 years, even the next 20 years?
I think the University of Michigan is poised to really increase its trajectory of influence around the world. I have so enjoyed my 12 years here, and I look forward to Mark Schlissel coming. I think he has a tremendous vision for the university going forward, and I think we've laid the groundwork for many, many important advances that will be made in the future. So for me, the future is bright for the university, and I'm really going to be looking forward to cheering from the sidelines.
What will you most miss?
Oh, I've loved every part of it, but I've loved the interaction with students. Every day, the students give me an energy. I am sort of constantly amazed at what they're taking on and what they're doing. I'll miss a lot of parts, but I'll miss the students perhaps the most.
What won't you miss?
Oh, dear. Well, what I'm looking forward to is controlling my own calendar. I haven't been able to do that for 19 years because I've been a university president both at Iowa and here for 19 years. So that's going to be different for me.
Mary Sue Coleman, outgoing president of the University of Michigan, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
It is one of the largest one-day celebrations of classic cars in the whole world. Some 40,000 classic cars cruising a 16-mile stretch of Woodward Avenue from Ferndale to Pontiac, with 1.5 million people lining the curbs to watch and take photos. It began in 1995 as a little fundraiser. Invite vintage cars to come cruise on Woodward Avenue and then remember the great cruising days of the 50s and 60s when kids would pile into those Impalas and Mustangs and Chargers and cruise up and down Woodward Avenue, stopping at a string of now legendary and closed drive-in restaurants. Now, the official event is August 16th, but to those who love driving those classic cars and those who love to see them, one day is not enough. As soon as the weather is warm enough, you will find cars out cruising Woodward and spectators lugging their lawn chairs to sit curbside and watch. And that's just too much of a good thing for many residents who live near Woodward, especially in the Oakland County city of Royal Oak, where they're complaining about the screeching tires, the revving engines, and the unmistakable roar of glass pack mufflers. Jim Ellison is the mayor of Royal Oak. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, we know, as I was saying, the official Dream Cruise is August 16th. How long does the unofficial action happen on Woodward?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the Dream Cruise proper, you know, that's an event that's held in August, and usually the week before that is what we consider Dream Cruise Week.
Right.
Everything that happens prior to that is the same kind of things that have been happening for decades out on Woodward Avenue from, you know, when I was a kid. And you get out there on the weekend nights and you cruise, and it's been happening forever. So, you know, the Dream Cruise is just a celebration of that. So
mm-hmm.
So I don't know if the Dream Cruise itself has inspired a lot of people to start getting out cruising more, or whether they're just continuing with what they've always been doing.
And I know just from driving Woodward, I saw people coming out even in April. There they were with their folding chairs, mm-hmm. watching cars. So it is a summer-long thing. What does it mean for the neighbors who live near Woodward? Can you tell us what you're hearing from them?
Well, yeah. I mean, the neighbors that live real close, they do hear the cars, they hear the traffic, they hear the tires, and you know, from that perspective, we have, you know, police patrols out there, and you know, we look for the people that are behaving badly. We, you know, we'll pull them over for, you know, screeching tires or loud exhaust or just, you know, creating mayhem. But the reality is, you know, people, it's a public highway. People are going to drive on it, so we just can't stop them from driving on it. And, you know, if we happen to have a police officer in the location where someone's speeding, then, you know, we're going to be able to do something. But you know, more likely than not, there's more going to be more cruisers than police. So what we try to do is have a strong presence. We have a lot of cars out there that are very visibly marked that, you know, this is police. And so it's a visual deterrent for a lot of people. But, you know, there's only so much you can do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can push them out of a certain area, and then they're just going to go somewhere else because they're going to congregate. And again, that's nothing new. This has been going on since I was in high school 40-some years ago. So,
you know, Mayor Ellison, it does strike me that what you're dealing with, it's too much of a good thing to some residents. That's being faced around Michigan. We actually recently had a conversation with the mayor of Traverse City, who's dealing with residents that are feeling a little frustrated with the flood of wonderful festivals that happen in Traverse City, and that the traffic gets heavier, we can't get to our park. That has to be a balancing act that you and city government have to try to deal with, right? To kind of bring in these exciting events, at the same time maintain the sense of place that the residents, that the locals want to have with their city.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, when the Dream Cruise started 20 years ago, we kind of embraced it. I was involved in the committee. I was actually the first chairman of the committee when we started 20-some years ago. And the thought at that time was, at least in the case of Royal Oak, we had a downtown that was vibrant and alive, and we had Woodward merchants who weren't getting a lot of that activity. So we thought this would be a good way to bring, you know, people out on Woodward Avenue, and then the merchants could participate and whatever. At that time, none of us had any idea it was going to be as big as it is, and it's just snowballed. But still, that's kind of where it came from. So it was an endeavor to try to bring some commerce to the Woodward Avenue businesses, and without really thinking that it was going to be as effective as it was. And so we're dealing with the neighbors that have problems. And in fairness, it's not all the neighbors. There are a lot of neighbors up and down Woodward that love this event. They participate as much as anybody else, and it's kind of exciting. But, you know, you got to take everybody in consideration. So you try to get out there and control the people that are creating havoc out there, and it's certainly not the majority of them. There's a lot of people out there that drive their cars and don't create problems. They understand the rules and they're courteous, and they just want to be with their friends and talk about cars. I mean, it's the Motor City. We all grew up with if our parents weren't in the automobile industry, then our uncles, aunts, and you know, it's in our blood. The Motor City is in our blood, and we deal with cars. I mean, my wife is from Pennsylvania. She doesn't get it at all.
Yeah, I have a husband from Ireland who doesn't get it either.
So, but you know, you've had to have grown up here and understand what the car culture means to this area of the state, and it's very important. We love our cars and we love to show them off, and it's just it's a good event. I mean, I'm out there myself on some Saturdays and Friday nights and enjoying what happens.
Jim Ellison is the mayor of Royal Oak in Oakland County, right in the epicenter of Dream Cruising, both official and unofficial. Mayor, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Details came out today regarding how General Motors will compensate victims of its defective ignition switches, linked to 13 deaths and 54 injuries. Attorney Kenneth Feinberg will run the General Motors Ignition Compensation Fund. Who's eligible? When and how do they file a claim? And how much money are we talking about? Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton joins us to help sort it all out. First, Kenneth Feinberg, he has some solid experience in this field, doesn't he, Tracy?
He does indeed. He handled most of the highest profile U.S. victims compensation programs we're aware of in recent years, from the 9/11 fund to the BP oil spill to the Newtown shootings program. And in most of those situations, he got anywhere from 87% to 100% buy-in from the people who were eligible for the programs. So he clearly has a lot of experience in figuring out what works best in all kinds of situations, whether it involves corporate wrongdoing or not.
Who's eligible and who isn't?
Okay, so this is complicated. I'm going to start at the beginning.
Okay.
GM admits it delayed a recall of 2.6 million vehicles with a faulty ignition switch for 11 years. The switch could turn off the car and disable the seatbelts and the airbags. So the vehicles that had the switch, they're all small cars, none of which GM makes anymore, including in the U.S. the Chevy Cobalts and the HHRs. So if the car was made before in or before 2007, we know it had the bad switch. Then after that, GM replaced the switch with one that didn't cause accidents, but some of the newer cars had a possibly defective replacement switch put in. So those cars also are in this program. And the company says it knows about 13 deaths and 54 injuries from accidents related to this switch. So if somebody was hurt or killed in an accident because the bad switch turned off the seatbelts and the airbags, that person is eligible. And it does not matter if they were also doing things they shouldn't have been doing.
Like texting?
Texting, okay. Driving drunk, speeding.
Okay. How much will victims get, or might they expect to get?
Well, for people who were killed or who had catastrophic injuries, the base amount is $1 million plus $300,000 for a spouse and for each dependent, plus lifetime costs of care for people who have the catastrophic injuries. Also, there's no cap, no upper limit, either for the individual payments or for the overall program.
So it sounds like crunching a lot of actuarial tables is going to be involved in figuring this out.
Yeah.
Now, how involved is GM going to be as Kenneth Feinberg processes these claims?
Well, GM's going to be writing checks. That's about it. GM can offer Mr. Feinberg its opinions on individual cases. But here's Mr. Feinberg from the press conference being pretty clear about who is the decider.
GM may not challenge it in court. GM may not reject it. GM may say that they think we made a mistake. That's fine. But they have to honor it. And they have to pay the claim.
And what is the most important part of that claim, Tracy?
Well, people are going to have to show, maybe not prove as in a court of law, but show pretty clearly that the ignition switch defect was the proximate cause of the accident that resulted in the injury or the death. So, but for the ignition switch turning off the airbags and the seatbelts, the accident wouldn't have happened. And it is not going to be easy to prove in some instances. Some of these accidents happened years ago, and there's going to be evidence from police reports, black boxes, witness statements, and the like.
And what kind of timetable? When can people start? When are they going to start submitting? And when do they think this will be wrapped up?
People will be able to file a claim starting on August 1st. And the deadline for getting that claim put in is December 31st. And Mr. Feinberg says he's going to move pretty quickly, up to between 90 days and 180 days to decide on a claim. So by, middle of next year, we may actually know whether GM was sort of right on base with these 13 deaths and 54 accidents and injuries, or whether it's higher.
Thanks for explaining that for us, Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton. Thanks, Tracy.
Happy to be here.
And General Motors announced today 6 new recalls affecting more than 7.5 million vehicles, these from 1997 to 2014. Among the recall vehicles, GM's aware of 7 crashes, 8 injuries, and 3 fatalities. The fatal crashes occurred in older model full-size sedans being recalled for inadvertent ignition key rotation. GM says there's no conclusive evidence that that defect condition caused the crashes.
In the Middle Ages, they called it succession powder, a poison that was sneaky yet powerful. Can't taste it, can't smell it. Yet it was a killer for those who wanted to get rid of a pesky king or queen. That silent but deadly poison is arsenic. And as we speak, there are people in Michigan getting arsenic every time they drink the water that comes out of their taps, water that has arsenic levels well above the federal standards. Michigan Radio's The Environment Reports is presenting a five-part series this week. It's called Michigan's Silent Poison, in partnership with the Center for Public Integrity and the public radio show Reveal. We're joined now by The Environment Report's Rebecca Williams. Hello.
Hi, Cindy.
And we welcome David Heath with the Center for Public Integrity. Hello, David.
Hi, Cindy.
Rebecca, start by telling us what happens to our bodies when we ingest arsenic.
So in extremely high doses, it can kill you, as you just mentioned. And then arsenic can also cause cancer. It's been linked to cancer of the lungs, bladder, skin, kidneys, prostate, liver. You can also experience arsenic poisoning, symptoms like nausea, headaches, gastrointestinal pain, vomiting, diarrhea. And we've also interviewed some experts who say that almost no organ system goes untouched by arsenic. And researchers are finding evidence of links between arsenic at lower doses and cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And there's some new research out of Columbia University that found loss of IQ points in kids who were exposed to really low levels of arsenic in their well water.
And how are we most likely to get that arsenic into our bodies, David?
Everybody gets arsenic. You eat it in food. It's in rice. It's in apple juice. It's in beer and wine. But it's also in drinking water, and it's especially high, can be especially high in private wells. So a lot of people in Michigan have private wells, especially in the Thumb region, and they may not realize that they may be drinking levels of arsenic that are well beyond the EPA standard.
And what is it, Rebecca, about Michigan that makes this a problem with the arsenic concentrations?
Well, so there's a formation called the Marshall Sandstone that underlays a good portion of the Thumb and beyond in Michigan. USGS researchers, U.S. Geological Survey researchers that I talked to, though, say that it could be from glacial deposits, not just this Marshall Sandstone, but also some other kinds of rock, and the arsenic can get from that rock into groundwater. And if you have a well drilled at a particular depth that comes into contact with that arsenic, it gets into the water.
The areas or the counties in Michigan that especially have to have this on top of mind.
Sure. So the Thumb region, as David mentioned, is the place where the highest levels of arsenic are found. So there's a map from the USGS that they put out, and you see when you look at that map, the Thumb region is colored red. And that indicates that levels there are above 50 parts per billion generally, which is five times what the federal government says is acceptable. But there are levels in the Thumb as high as 20 times or higher than the federal acceptable limit for arsenic.
What about other counties? Does it work further south? If I'm in southeast Michigan, is that something, if I've got a well, I need to think about?
Yes. Actually, Washtenaw, Livingston, Oakland, Ingham, other counties in the southeast Michigan area do have elevated arsenic levels in certain spots.
And David, this isn't a concern for people who get their drinking water from a municipal system, right? Because there's a federal law that protects those folks?
Well, that's not entirely clear. I mean, I think people who drink municipal water are much better protected than people who drink well water. But as Rebecca mentioned, Columbia University just published a study that showed that children in Maine who were drinking arsenic even at levels at half the level of the drinking water standard were scoring an average of 6 points lower on IQ tests than kids who weren't exposed to arsenic. So even below the standard, there may be some harmful effects.
But the folks at the private wells, it's really all up to you, right? There's nothing to...
Yeah, it's completely up to you because there's no state requirement for testing of wells for arsenic. Some counties have some rules, but if you're on a private well, nobody's going to tell you that you have to test it.
Rebecca, you spoke with a mom who could not figure out why was her family getting sick after they moved into their house in Ortonville in Oakland County. Tell us about her.
So back in the 1990s, Renee Thompson and her family moved into this house, and they were sick. They started getting sick, and they were sick for 3 years without having any idea why.
My son, who was six at the time, well, six, seven, he started to have severe chest pains. My older daughter had headaches, my husband had GI bleeding. I became very fatigued, a lot of headaches, skin problems.
So they saw 12 different doctors, and it wasn't until the 13th doctor that they had some answers. And they were tested for cancer, lupus, all kinds of things, but all of those tests came back negative. And then this 13th doctor, Dr. Edward Adler, remembered a case of arsenic poisoning that he had seen decades earlier and thought, well, the symptoms are hard to diagnose because they can mimic a lot of other things.
Certainly.
And so what he did was he had Renee do a urine arsenic test, and her levels came back higher than he thought they should be. And then she tested her well and found out that her well water had arsenic that was higher than it should be. And so they stopped drinking the water, and over a couple of weeks, they started to feel better. They still have some effects. This happened 20 years ago. They still have some lingering effects in their systems. But what was really striking to me is that Renee went to the papers and tried to raise awareness 20 years ago. And there was a push for some more awareness of arsenic in Michigan, but it's fallen off the radar, and a lot of people have no idea this is going on.
Which makes me wonder, David Heath, who should be out there warning the folks with the well water, you need to be aware, get your water tested?
Well, one good thing about this program is that I think we're doing it right now, but I think that the county health departments and the state have probably an obligation to be telling people that they should be checking their well water and testing it to make sure that it's doesn't have a lot of arsenic in it, which it could.
Right, and this varies depending on which county you talk to. And for example, in Washtenaw and Livingston, there are some rules. In Washtenaw County, you have a point of sale program. So when you sell your house, it has to be tested for arsenic. If the levels are above the federal acceptable limit of 10, they want to have you test it, or they want to have you treat it. But in other places like Lapeer and Genesee County, there are no requirements. And David and I found when we interviewed a local county health official in Lapeer that she told us, we don't want to have awareness be so high that people freak out about it. So she didn't. There's a very, different sense of importance based on who you talk to and in which county.
If you've just joined us, we are talking with the Environment Report's Rebecca Williams and with David Heath with the Center for Public Integrity as the Environment Report presents a 5-part series this week called Michigan Silent Poison in partnership with the Center for Public Integrity and the Public Radio Show Reveal as we look at the silent but deadly poison of arsenic. And David Heath, research is certainly indicating arsenic can be more powerful and more harmful than thought, and that exposure at lower doses can be harmful. And the EPA came out with a draft report on cancer risks from arsenic, and that was back in 2010, which would basically, wouldn't it be step one of the EPA tightening drinking water standards? What were those findings?
Right. The EPA has been trying to update its assessment of arsenic since 2003, and it's gone through quite a few delays. And in 2010, they finally had a draft out that said that actually arsenic was 17 times more potent as a carcinogen than they're currently reporting. And what 17 times more potent means is if 100,000 women are more vulnerable to arsenic. So if 100,000 women drank the legal limit of arsenic every day, 730 of them would get lung and bladder cancer from it, according to the EPA. That's quite an extraordinary number. Usually the EPA, in setting standards, they ideally try to set the number of cancers to 1 in 1,000,000.
Wow.
So this is, 7,000 times that,
And then that draft report went poof. It never materialized. Tell us why.
Yes. So we looked at what happened to this process where the EPA was just about, after so many years, they were just about to release their findings. And that would have probably triggered awareness in Michigan. It might have, created a new drinking water standard. But there was a member of Congress from Idaho, Mike Simpson, who was lobbied by a group of companies, including mining companies. But there were two pesticide companies that had a weed killer on the market that had arsenic in it. And they were set to be banned by the end of last year. By delaying the EPA's scientific assessment, they were able to actually get the EPA to lift the ban. So Mike Simpson put some language into the appropriations bill from 2012 that blocked the EPA from releasing its findings or taking any actions based on them.
So you tracked down Congressman Simpson and talked with him?
Yes. Yes. And he said he acknowledged that he did it. And he said what he's concerned about are two things, really, that he's concerned about whether or not the EPA does good science. And he's also concerned about the cost to water companies of having to meet these standards.
What does this say to both of you as far as the kind of protection that I think the public comes to expect from the government and from the EPA, Rebecca?
I think that there's a sense of, you know, the government couldn't drink this water if it weren't safe. And I think that something that's really important to understand is that actually these levels that are set are, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, but there's also a major cost-benefit analysis that goes on. So it's like, what will it cost to take the level down to a certain place? David, you could talk more about this, but I think it's like the levels they were discussed setting them even lower back in, you know, a decade
right.
or so ago.
But it seems that politics injects itself again.
Right. Originally, the EPA was going to have the standard half of what it currently is. But then there was a political battle back then. This is in 2000, and they decided to raise it to 10 parts per billion, as Rebecca mentioned. Maybe what they're finding now is that maybe they should have gone to the lower standard.
What are the best steps for someone to find out whether arsenic's in their water? You want to protect yourself and protect your family, Rebecca.
So the first thing you can do is take a water sample, and it's really easy to do that. You can contact the state. The Department of Environmental Quality has a lab. You can contact them, get a sample bottle, find out how to test. Also on our website, michiganradio.org, we have well testing guidelines today that you can see. And you also can, there are also EPA certified labs that you can test your water at. You just take a sample and you'll get the results back, and then you'll have a sense of, is it above this 10 parts per billion, and then you can get advice, and we also will have advice on our website on how to treat your water if it is too high.
So you can treat it. You don't have to be running out necessarily buying bottled water. There are steps you can take to treat the water coming out of your taps.
Yeah, absolutely. And reverse osmosis is one that is often mentioned that researchers have studied. It does depend a bit on how high your levels are. Some of these levels in the hundreds or 200 that you might encounter in certain parts of Michigan, you might have to take some extra steps.
You can learn more about arsenic in Michigan at michiganradio.org, and then check out David Heath's story about the battle over arsenic in Congress on Reveal, a new program from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. It's at revealradio.org. David Heath from the Center for Public Integrity and Rebecca Williams of the Environment Report here at Michigan Radio. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we speak with Detroit Police Chief James Craig. One topic, police response time.
Calls were just not being answered. And then Detroiters who I had conversations with constantly said, you know, why call the police? They're not going to come.
That's tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed and produced by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.